I guess we can start a little early. Won't hurt. Chapter 9 of Matthew. This is what you see on the screen is the way that the ninth chapter seems to outline itself. But that's not how I want to approach that this evening. We'll do something a little bit different. Look at this is what I see primarily when I look at Matthew chapter 9, and that's miracles. First eight verses, the healing of a man who had been paralyzed, and then in verses 18 through 35, which is the bulk of the chapter, you've got a woman raised from the dead, a woman with 12 years of hemorrhaging that was cured, a blind man, a demon-possessed man, and then it just says every disease and sickness, which covers a whole lot of territory. And I want to eventually look at that tonight. Hopefully we'll have enough time to do that. What I want to do, and this is the end of the chapter, of the call of Matthew, the question about fasting, and then some concerns about Jesus. All of these contain lessons that we need to take a look at. But I want to take a look at this thing about miracles. The liberal theologians, I don't know at one time if there was a conservative bunch of theologians in the various denominations. I really don't know. I don't remember back that far. I'm old, but not that old. But nowadays, it's not anything unusual to find Presbyterians, Methodists, liberal branches of that denomination, and others who really ridicule the concept of miracles. They Old and New Testament. They're an equal opportunity criticizer. And without Bible miracles, I don't think some of these people have stopped to think, or if they even care, that without Bible miracles, the Bible, you've gutted the Bible. You've absolutely gutted it. And the Bible is just another book. When they get through with it, it's like reading an encyclopedia or something. The God of the Bible is only a God, little g God, one of many. They're polytheistic as far as they're concerned. Jesus is merely a man. As we'll see tonight, if we can get that far, it was the miracles that proved his what? What did the miracles of Jesus prove? There you go, the deity. Yeah, he was the Son of God, and he proved it by the miracles. So you strip away miracles, and you've stripped Jesus of his uniqueness. You've stripped him of his deity. Like I said, I don't know that they've thought about this. On the other hand, I don't know that they care. And then finally, Christianity is just another religious system. Now, this has really come to the forefront in the last, I don't know, two or three decades when you've got this woke nonsense, and we can't say that anybody has an ultimate truth and all of that. This fits right into that kind of thinking. We can't have anything that says, you know, I am the God, I am the Christ, the book of the Bible is the book. We can't talk that way. We can't put the definite article in front of anything and act like it's the exclusive way to look at things, way to go. And so because of that, and I learned a long time ago not to assume when I stand up before an audience, even like this, mostly of older people, but I've learned not to assume, oh, everybody believes. Everybody believes in miracles. No, they don't. And I don't believe, especially with younger people, that I don't know how much teaching they've had on it. You probably hear done a good job of that. But I just, I don't know. In those little minds, the idea of miracles needs to be hammered over and over and over and over again. And we can't assume, like I said, I've known of young people that when I was growing up, kids my age, that you grew up thinking, well, they know all about miracles. They know all about all these things. They don't. And they get out into the world, they get into higher education, and they lose their faith because they're presented another viewpoint, and they never did have the original viewpoint presented to them. So I like whenever I have the chance, and as I was reading through Matthew 9, I thought, well, here's my chance to go back over some of my miracle material and share it with you and just throw it open, let you see what you think about it. All right. Back in the Old Testament, Psalm 77, verse 14. You are the God who performs miracles. You display your power among the people. David wrote that. And he said, you are a God who performs miracles. Now, some of the same people who will get into the 23rd Psalm and get all weepy about it. Oh, that's so beautiful. Oh, that's so wonderful. But to come here to this statement in verse 14 of Psalm 77 and pick it apart and deny that God is a God of miracles. Well, if we can pick apart chapter 7:14 and rule out a God who performs miracles, then I could go to Psalm 23 and rip it apart. Why not? Once you start down the road of ripping apart the Bible and what the Bible teaches, where's the stopping place? You know, it's just really absurd. So, Exodus 34:10. Then God said, behold, I'm going to make a covenant before all your people. I will perform miracles which have not been produced in all the earth, nor among any of the nations. And all the people among whom you live will see the working of the Lord, for it is a fearful thing that I am going to perform with you. I want you to look at that word fearful for just a second. The word fearful does not mean scary. And God is not saying here, when I do miracles, you're going to be scared. Now, there may have been some, there was an element of that, but that really, that's not what the word fearful means here. It means awe, A-W-E, awe-inspiring, awe-producing. It's the kind of activities that when people saw it, they went, whoa. You know, in fact, that's the word sign that's used in the New Testament is, there are, what, three or four different kinds of Greek words that look at a miracle. Sign is one of them. And a sign means something that when you see it, you think, yeah, it's God did that. Well, that's what these miracles are that Moses is being told here were going to be performed. Nothing had ever been done like this, except crossing the Red Sea, perhaps. Perhaps they remember that little miracle there. But anyway, Old Testament, filled with miracles. The book of Genesis and Exodus is full of them. And perhaps some of the most amazing miracles, and I hate to say some are more amazing than others, but when you get into studying Elijah and Elisha, there are some things there that just really blow your mind, the things that they did. And this is what is being said here. It is a fearful thing I'm going to perform with you, awe-inspiring. When I get through doing the miracles that I'm going to produce, you're going to know, or at least you should come to the conclusion, that there is a God and that I am He. All right, let's go to the New Testament now. This is, I think it's a complete list of all of the miracles in Luke's gospel. Now, why I'm singling out Luke, we'll get to shortly. Beginning with the virgin, the virgin conception, and the virgin birth, and then ending in Luke, the resurrection of Christ. and then everything in between. These are extremely significant things that Luke recorded. And we're going to see just why as we go along. Then when we leave the book of Luke, we get into the book of Acts, and Luke wrote Acts. What was Luke's occupation? What did he do? He was a doctor. That becomes very, very important as we look at these things. Yeah, that's right. He was a doctor. All right. So in the book of Acts, a lot of miracles are recorded by Luke. And there are those who go through Luke, the gospel, go through Acts, and especially the travels of Paul, and just blow all of that stuff off, that things that Paul did, things that other people did that were miraculous, and just deny that those were his actual historical events that took place. The reliability of Luke in the book of Acts. I'm leading up to something here. Specific names. Luke mentions 95 different people, 62 of which aren't mentioned by any other New Testament writer. 27 are non-believers, mostly civil or military officials. Now again, this will become important in a second. Specific titles. The Roman government, as they went around in conquering cultures and nations like the Jews, they would divide the country up, and I can't recall these off the top of my head. I should have looked it up. There were two kinds of districts. You remember what they are? Okay, I don't either. There were two kinds of districts that a country was divided up into, and they were overseen by two different types of men. When the colony, when the district changed, however they changed, why they changed, and one district became another district and so forth, the ruler changed. His title changed. Guess what? Luke gets into that. He never misses a beat. Not once does he. He calls these lesser officers in these districts by their proper title at the proper time that they were overseeing a district that required that they use that particular title. All right. Specific places. 32 countries, 54 cities, and 9 Mediterranean islands. You get into that on the ship journey that Paul took to Rome. And again, he gets all of those right. Acts 11, Acts 18, there were two events. The drought throughout all the world. This is when money was raised by brethren to take care of the needs of the needy saints in Jerusalem. And the expulsion of Jews from Rome. Now, in all of these things that Luke mentions, Luke never made a mistake. For 2,000 years, the critics have been picking over Luke and especially Acts. They have been trying to find something that shows that Luke got it wrong. Now, this brings us to this fella. Anybody ever heard of him? Didn't think so. Sir William Ramsay lived up until 1939. He was from England, raised an atheist, and he was trained as an archaeologist. And as he got into adulthood, after he married, he and his wife set out on a journey throughout all of what we would call the Bible lands, except it wasn't confined just to Jerusalem in that area. It concentrated really upon the part of the world that Paul traveled in his preaching tours. So they set out with this anti-Bible bias to show that the Bible was absolutely wrong. And Luke was wrong when he talked about all these places, all these people, all these events, all that stuff. Luke did not know what he was talking about. Okay, at the conclusion of his travels, he wrote a book, and I don't know if this book is still in print or not, The Bearing of Recent Discoveries on the Trustworthiness of the New Testament. Let me just give you one sentence of his conclusion. This former atheist said, Luke is an historian of the first rank. Not merely are his statements of fact trustworthy, the author should be placed along with the very greatest historians. That's a former atheist that wrote that. And he and his wife are going to travel the then known world to prove Luke wrong. And guess what? What happened to him and his wife is the same thing that would happen today if people embarked upon the same kind of journey, not literal, but figuratively, if they would embark upon the journey to examine the evidence, to see just, you know, how does this thing in Luke and Acts pan out? It was Luke right in the things that he wrote down. That would happen if people had the same kind of attitude that William Ramsey and his wife had. So, a few years ago, in fact, a long time ago, I got to looking at this thing about miracles, and I didn't have any problems with accepting the miracles, but I wanted to do some preaching and teaching on miracles in the Bible, and I wanted to find some way to approach the subject that would be convincing to people, or people with an open mind to be convincing to them. And I just didn't know how to do it. I was just back and forth about the proper approach to take to showing that miracles really, really did occur. And one day I got this little book. It's a little paperback, and I don't even know if it's still in print. And I mean, it's a little old thin paperback. I got to reading that thing. You can read through it in an hour or less. And this guy, John Montgomery, I think he's dead now. The little book is called History and Christianity. And you probably had the same experience that I've had, like with this book. I got to reading this book, and I thought, wow, where's this guy been all my life? And then I came across one statement, or a couple of statements, I guess, a couple of sentences that he wrote, and I thought, man, this is great stuff. And in the 35 or 40 years since then, I haven't changed my mind. Here's what changed me as far as my approach to establishing that miracles really did occur. Montgomery said, the only way we can know whether an event can occur is to see whether, in fact, it has occurred. I read that and I thought, golly, that's pretty profound. Just one sentence. How do you know if in the past a thing occurred or not? Well, you take a look at whether or not it had occurred. And then he says this to explain what he meant. The problem of miracles, then, must be solved in the realm of historical investigation, not in the realm of philosophical speculation. Wow, that is fantastic. Whether or not miracles occurred is not a theological thing. It has nothing to do with theology. Well, believing in it has nothing to do, proving it has nothing to do with reading the Bible so much and coming up with some deep theological arguments, no. Whether or not the miracles that are recorded by Luke in the Gospel and in Acts, whether or not those events occurred, we need to ask ourselves, did they occur? Is there any historical evidence that they occurred? I don't know how many of you, a few years ago, I was getting up at 4:30, 5 o'clock to go do my running. I'd turn on the radio, And I guess I got tuned into XERG. Anybody know what XERG is? Oh, boy. It's a 50,000 watt or 500,000 watt station down in Ciudad Acuna, right across from Del Rio. And they broadcast everything. They sell splinters from the cross. This is no joke. They sell holy water that if you buy it and drink it, you'll never die, basically. Weird stuff. Well, along with those guys were the guys who denied that the miracles of Jesus were actually real. And they also denied that the moon landings and the moon walks had occurred. That thing was filmed. This is what they're saying. All of that was filmed in Arizona deserts. Doctored the film up a little bit, but yeah, we didn't go to the moon. And the moonwalk, come on. No, absolutely not. So here we have six alleged trips to the moon. If Wikipedia is right, those figures are right. There have been six alleged trips to the moon from 1969 to 1972. There were six manned landings of space vehicles of one kind or another, and 12 men have walked on the moon. Really? Did that really happen? How are you going to establish in somebody's mind that those things really occurred? And here's how you do it. Going back to Montgomery and what he had to say. You ask the question, not can that happen, because it's not happening now. Obviously, we haven't done anything on the moon since 72. 72, I guess. Is it possible that occurred? Well, you answer that question by asking yourself, has it ever occurred? Is there any historical evidence? Now, Montgomery, in his little book, that statement I read, he wasn't talking about moon landings, but the principle applies. How do you present good evidence that we have gone to the moon, landed on the moon, walked on the moon? How do you do that? Well, you do it by looking at the historical evidence. A lot has, volumes and volumes and volumes have been written on the space program, and especially the time when we were going to the moon. You go back and look at audio and video material. You examine that. Is there any evidence to suggest that written audio and video material has all been corrupted? That NASA is just one big, giant propaganda machine for saying that something happened that didn't happen? Really? You mean to tell me you really think that's the case? Or do you look at the audio, video, and written material about the moon and you say, yeah, I may not like that conclusion, but I can't help but reach that conclusion because the historical evidence leads me to that conclusion. You do the same thing with the miracles of the New Testament and the Old Testament. You take a look at the historical evidence and you ask yourself, is it reasonable to believe that those events recorded by Luke in Acts and Luke, and that others recorded like Matthew in Matthew chapter 9, those things really take place? Or did those 12 apostles get together, have a little meeting one day and said, look, let's pull a funny on people. Let's start writing about miracles. And let's paint Jesus as being a man who went over the land of Palestine and he did miracles, Yeah, that ought to be funny. And get everybody to believe it. And who knows, they may start some kind of a religion around that nonsense. And so they got together and they did it, and poof, here's Christianity 2,000 years later. Is there anything in your moments of complete sanity that would lead you to that conclusion? That explains the miracles that are recorded in both the Old Testament and the New Testament? Or do you look at that evidence and think, there's no way? No way that anybody could have pulled off some kind of a trick on people and manufactured a man who went around the land of Judea and did so-called miracles. No, you can't. The sane, the rational conclusion is, yeah. Whether I like that or not, whether I agree with it or not, yeah. The evidence, the historical evidence, leads me to the conclusion that those events actually took place. Now, I don't know how many, I think David has his book, don't you? This is one of the best books. I bought this book several years ago. I was going through a bookstore, and I saw it, and I liked the title. I thought, anybody can come up with a title like that, it's all right. Yeah, I love that title, and I bought it basically on the basis of that title. I took it home. This book has, I don't know, over 300 pages in it. I read it in one sitting with a marker. And I would just, every page, I would just mark. One of the best books I have ever read. And one of the reasons it's such a good book, now this was co-authored by Norman Geisler and Frank Turek. One of the reasons it's such a good book is because of this guy here. Now, he's dead now, which was a big law. I do not know what his religious affiliation was. If you go on YouTube, and I think he was a Methodist or Presbyterian. This is a little off the subject. But I looked up to see if he was doing any videos on apologetics, and he did. There are a lot of them on YouTube. But also, there is a lot of videos by Norm Geisler against Calvinism. I thought, this is some of the best material against Calvinism I have ever listened to. So if you want to look at something, and which shows what an independent thinker he was, because he was a member of a religious and a Methodist or something like that, that they were at odds with him over Calvinism and the five major points of Calvinism. That's off the subject. All I'm saying is Norm Geisler is an independent thinker, or was an independent thinker. And he was, and this is my opinion, and I know that it is, he was, in my lifetime, all the stuff I've read, this is the best guy on apologetics. Now, you can go online and just do a search. Go to Google and do a search for Geisler and apologetics. And a lot of his material is downloadable. It was a link over to a lot of his material is, you can either look at it online or copy it and paste it and use it that way, as long as you give him credit if you're going to pass out the material. But anyway, here's what he said on the matter of miracles in this book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. And he's talking specifically about Luke and the book of Acts. Now, why would Luke be so accurate with trivial details like wind direction, water depth, peculiar town names, but not be accurate when it comes to important events like miracles? For non-believers, explain that. Luke, as we said a moment ago, Luke never missed it in Acts or Luke. Everything he said, he never made a mistake. And so much of it involved, as we saw on that slide, the names of people, of towns, and events and so on. Some of them are obscure, but he got it right. And in 2,000 years, nobody has ever proven Luke wrong. Geisler went on, in light of the fact that Luke has proven accurate with so many trivial details, it is nothing but pure anti-supernatural bias to say that he's not telling the truth about the miracles he records. Now, statements like that and the way Geisler reasons things out is, I admire his mind. He's got a brilliant, brilliant mind. So if you want to do some study in apologetics, obviously the first book you go to, the Bible presents a lot of evidence that needs to be considered in that regard. But if you want something that's extra biblical, a little help in formulating arguments and so forth, you'll not do any better than buying this book and doing a whole lot of study out of that book. With your, I don't have enough faith to be an atheist here in your Bible here, okay? All right. All right. Now, any questions, any comments on all that stuff about miracles? Anybody? Was that as clear as mud, or?
I'll just make a statement, and I don't know if this is agreeing or disagreeing with you, and that's not really the point I'm trying to make, but if we become solely reliant on evidence of a miracle to prove that a miracle happened, then I think we're in dangerous territory. Meaning, Jesus' birth. There's no physical evidence known to man. I mean, sure, there's a lot of people that say they have all these different pieces of it, and they know where it happened, and there's temples built around it and all that, but we don't know that. There's no physical evidence that we know for sure that that took place. Right?
Right.
So, based on the assumption that we have to have physical evidence to be able to prove that a miracle happened, then we can't prove that Jesus was killed, resurrected, and reborn and went to heaven. We don't have physical evidence that that took place. And I think our faith has to be grounded in believing in the unknown or the unseen. And so I think we get in dangerous territory when we say that we have to have physical evidence to prove a miracle.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Evidence is cool, yeah. And I think there's definitely physical evidence to prove some miracle.
Yeah.
But if we say we have to have the physical evidence to prove a miracle, then I think that's dangerous.
I see what you're saying. I've had a problem for a long time, and I probably shouldn't even venture out on this one. I've had a problem for a long time with these guys that are in search of Noah's Ark. I hope they never find it. I hope they never find it. Like you, my faith does not depend upon them scratching around on Mount Ararat and saying, ah, there it is. All you have to do is look at Jesus. That's the best proof we have. He mentions Noah, the ark, and the flood. That's it. You know, what other evidence do you need? So I see what you're saying. I think it helps sometimes as we're trying to establish faith. Paul did this, I think, in Romans 1 when he talks about the wrath of God being revealed against heaven. I mean, from heaven against all unrighteousness and ungodliness of men. And then he talks about the fact that the unseen can be seen by what is seen. And he makes that argument. And so I think there is scriptural statements to lead me to the conclusion that, yeah, I can look outside of Scripture, as Paul did in Romans 1. Look at the stars. Look at the things that God has made. How do you explain that? And so I think there's a place for that. Can we go too far with that? Absolutely. Yeah, I think you're right that we can go too far with it. and leave the Bible alone. I'm just presenting this to try and help us with young people. You know, present some things to think about, some arguments that can help them move toward faith. Now, I don't know if any of that made sense or not, but I do see what you're saying, that there is a tendency to go too far with that. I understand what you're saying. Yeah.
Almost every historical fact, it's just my thinking, is almost entirely based on testimony. You go find somebody's headstone, that is a testimony. That's it. Did George Washington really exist? You're looking at testimony. There may be a lot of it, but it's all testimony. So what it comes back to is the validity of the testimony, the reliability of the source. And that's the evidence that you're pointing to a lot here is Luke reliable? And no matter what it is in history that we want to go back and document, did this happen? Did this person exist? It's all based on written record.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And either Luke was lying or he was telling the truth. And other Old and New Testament writers, we create faith in those who wrote what we call the Bible. And if they were wrong on one point, then all the dominoes go down. And we need to realize that. But yeah, your point's well taken. I think we can go too far with that. Anything else? Oh, Brett?
I was just going to dovetail on what J.D. said. And all that, the fact that testimony is the evidence, that's been that way for all of history until about 1900. We didn't have video or audio. Nowadays, we want to see it on, hear the audio or see the video, or maybe photography, I guess, before then. But for the vast majority of history, I mean, if we believe anything before about 1835, when the first photograph was made, it's all testimony. Yeah. Every last thing in history is testimony.
Anything else? Any other? What?
I just like how he phrased how Geisler phrased the second sentence here. If Luke has proven accurate with so many trivial details, why not believe that he's accurate with the greater details? It reminds me of the parable of the talents. Because you have been faithful with me over a few things, I'll make you ruler over many.
Yeah, I think that within reason, staying within certain parameters, we can go outside of the Bible text and look at evidence that establishes the validity of the Bible text, whether it's miracles or anything else. But again, we need to make sure we're careful on how we structure that, how we go about it. Okay, anything else? Any other questions or comments? All right. We're not going to have time to cover all of this, but we'll do what we can. These miracles that Matthew documents here in chapter 9, in chapter 9, verses 1 through 8, the healing of a man who was paralytic. But something took place that, to me, overrides almost the paralysis of this man and his healing. They come to Jesus, the unbelievers, the Pharisees and others. They brought to him, this is in verse 2, they brought to him a paralyzed man lying on a stretcher. And seeing their faith, Jesus said to the man who was paralyzed, "Take courage, son, your sins are forgiven." Now, there's a couple of things here I want to look at. It's easy to go through Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and look at Jesus going from town to town, healing the sick and raising the dead. And we just think, oh, isn't that lovely, isn't that sweet that Jesus went around. And his mission on earth was to heal people. Anybody believe that? Physically. That was his mission on earth, to heal people who had all kind of physical problems. Anybody believe that? I don't want to argue with it. Look at this. When a paralyzed man was brought to Jesus, what's the first thing that Jesus said to him? I'm so sorry that you've been paralyzed for so long. What did he say? What did he say? There you go. Thank you.
Was to forgive sins.
Absolutely. He was a doctor, all right, but a spiritual doctor, not a physical one. And the purpose of Jesus going around healing people and raising people from the dead was not, I'm not trying to remove the sympathy that I believe that Jesus had for people who had various conditions. I think that's right. But that wasn't his primary concern. Primary concern was their spiritual problems. So take courage, son, your sins are forgiven. And some of the scribes said to themselves. So when they said to themselves, what were they doing? That was in their mind. They weren't saying anything outwardly, but they were thinking, this man is blaspheming. And Jesus, perceiving their thoughts, said, why are you thinking evil in your hearts? What would you think of me if we were in conversation and all of a sudden I said, now you shouldn't be thinking about dub, 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 dub. You think, oh, God, how did he know in my mind? How did he know I was thinking about that? Good grief. Scary? A little bit. Would you think of that man that he's extra special? If he can read my minds and my thoughts, this is a very, very unique individual. And Jesus, perceiving their thoughts, said, why are you thinking evil in your hearts? They glossed over that. They didn't pay any attention to the fact that here is a man who was reading their minds, who knew their thoughts, and they focused upon a man, Jesus, who showed compassion, first of all, for this paralyzed man's spiritual condition, and secondly of all, for his physical condition, and restoring him to where he could walk. Okay, kids are coming in. Not going to have time. As usual, I've spent too much time on other things and not going to have time to look at these other things. Appreciate everybody listening. Appreciate your thoughts. Appreciate your comments. Thank you.